Okay, so any points that you wish to discuss come up in the teachings?
So, Gina at the very end talked about the five obscurations, and the first two, so you think they might be referring to obscurations towards meditation, specifically karma abiding?
Well, as you said, that the what they call excitement is specifically the one of the main distractions to karma abiding. And I guess regret for virtue, I mean, can be, it's not specifically an obscuration. I still can't see the connection. I mean, I hadn't heard that before. That was in relation to the five points, right? The two hands, the two knees, and the forehead. So most I've heard is the main mental factor the prostration overcomes is pride. And that could be laying the full body on the floor towards the object of prostration.
It was good because, again, just shows how little, how much subtlety there is in the Dharma teachings and how one of the verse can be pointed in so many different directions.
I only ever talking about people who are interested in fitness, and I think the inference was that that was a form of self-cherishing. But if the motivation for fitness is to keep your body and mind healthy and not related to appearance at all, is that still self-cherishing?
Oh, not necessarily. I've been known to go surfing for the benefit of all sentient beings. I'm not sure that there's self-cherishing there or not. Of course, everything depends upon the motivation. And indeed, it is important to keep your body healthy and also your mind relaxed. One of the Bodhisattva's activities is relaxation, like knowing when to take a break. Otherwise, we can burn out mentally and physically. So we need to know when to take a break, and then get back into what we were doing. So, of course, when the motivation is virtuous, it's not attachment, it's not a worldly concern. But if you look at most people, I think, you know, going to the gym, like, why are the gyms surrounded by mirrors? they want to show off their muscles and their lean body, and so much activity is done to displaying ourselves, either physically or the clothes we wear, or etc. So that's a worldly, non-virtuous motivation.
It seems a little bit loaded. Because after the retreat last year with me, I realised how it's much of a show what was going on. It was like really the self-cherishing mind is quite dominant, even when you seem to have a good motivation. So it's kind of hard to not for all really to not be motivated with a self-cherishing mind. Very subtle.
If we really check up our purpose for doing things, often there is an aspect of self-centeredness, self-cherishing or self-importance, even contaminating our virtuous actions. You know, it's like maybe you get the chance to lead the Lama into the teaching room or something, and so you're acting very humbly, you know. But you're thinking, hey, here am I, I'm leading the dialogue, and everybody's looking at me, I'm so important, so that can be there. I know, personal experience. Yeah, we really have to check up. As Lama Zopa presses this point so often, that we think we're doing virtue, but actually it's just self-concern which is contaminating our virtuous action. Yeah. Yeah, love, what we ordinarily call love, is indeed contaminated by attachment. So we have to reflect upon what attachment is. And essentially, when in this situation, there's a person who has been kind to us, who has pleased us, and helped us, then attachment, as its name suggests, is a type of clinging, not wanting to separate from them. Also, it has an element of, there is an element of exaggeration of the positive qualities upon the person to whom we're attached, and even an element of superimposition of non-existent positive qualities, as we cling to them even more. Attachment also has the function of blinding ourselves to their negative qualities, whereas love is just the pure thought or wish for the person that we love to be happy and to make them happy. So it's a very warm attitude without any strings attached, unconditional wish for them to be happy. That's the love that we want to cultivate. That's the virtuous love. So well, we just have to check up our mind whether we are attached or not, and combine it with reality. Of course, attachment also grasps the self and the other person to exist inherently from their own side as real entities, like, you know, that's coming from ignorance, but ignorance is the root of attachment. So what attachment grasps is an apparent inherently existing mother or father, which actually is false. But this is really helpful when they die.
A conditional process.
Yes, that's right.
So
each step depends upon the previous step.
Yeah. The sequence and that the strength of the love that is generated is developed in that.
That's right.
So it's highly conditional.
That's right.
Whereas there's this, I don't know if it's a fantasy or whatever, the idea of unconditional love.
That means, Mummy, I will like you if you give me the piece of cake. If you don't give me a piece of cake, Mummy, I hate you. That's the condition.
That's a condition, but I suppose there's perhaps this idea that we might have, whether it's a fantasy or not, that somehow or other we could generate love for others without going through a process that involves the conditions of developing that love through this mental exercise of the
word. Well, everything in the universe is conditioned by something else. There's nothing which is unconditioned by something else.
Yeah.
So there's no fault in following that sequence. You see, if we don't have thorough conviction that all sentient beings have been our mother countless times in the past, then the heartwarming love which we're aiming to generate, which is the fourth step, It won't work. Because we need to be thoroughly convinced that all these strangers and enemies, insects, cockroaches, have been my dear mother and have been so kind to me, and we should repay the kindness. So, as I mentioned yesterday, the fourth step of heartwarming love, the definition of that, but the experience of that is when every single sentient being appears to our eyes as pleasing, like a parent, you know, waiting for their child to come out of school. The other kids are just kids, but their kid is pleasing, and when the kid is laughing and happy, they're filled with warmth. So heartwarming love has that attitude towards every sentient being. So if we haven't been convinced that all sentient beings have been supremely kind to us as our mother and father and so on in past lives, we can't have heartwarming love. So that's the conditioning.
Yeah, which is kind of like sort of a challenging idea, because, and this is what I was suggesting about earlier, the fantasy, that it's a fantasy to think that if, for instance, we didn't have that idea of them previously being our mothers,
yep,
we just wouldn't love them.
That's right, exactly.
That's a fantasy.
A fantasy.
It's a fantasy to think that without this sort of process in place, we would actually generate universal love.
That's right. You can't generate bodhicitta without that initial recognition. Both. There are two methods that have survived for generating bodhicitta: the seven steps of cause and effect, and equalizing and exchanging. And both depend upon those first four steps.
Unconditioned love doesn't mean it's a love that doesn't have causes or conditions. It means it's not the love that says, I'll love you if that happens.
Yeah, you don't place conditions.
Question of definition. Yeah, of course it's conditioned because it's impermanent. It has causes.
That's unconditional love.
Well, yeah, unconditional. Yeah.
As in, if we had developed bodhicitta, then love would be without conditions, as opposed to the description of unconditional love being something that arose without, say, this process. Two separate ideas, as I said.
We have the term unconditional love,
yeah,
which means that we will like somebody provided they like me. You know, there's but like I said, I will like mummy if mummy gives me a big piece of cake. I will hate mummy if she doesn't give me that big piece of cake. You know, that's the condition. But it's not. And when we talk about conditioned, in terms of dependent arising, that means that things arise in dependence upon something else that causes and conditions for impermanent phenomena and reliance and comparison and in a subtle way the condition of mental imputation.
Yeah. I suppose the stimulation of what Andy's saying is if there's a conflict of the term, so the conflict being that the development of bodhicitta is conditional, say, on the sequence.
The development of
bodhicitta,
yeah,
is conditional on this sequence.
Yeah.
But then once bodhicitta has been developed,
yeah,
the love itself is without condition.
I think it's a word play.
Yeah, I think it's a word play.
It's a word play.
Conditional love that Catherine mentioned isn't love at all, it's blackmail.
Yeah, they're different things.
Yeah, that's the point.
Yeah.
I find it interesting about your point of view on how the Kishas talk about the generating bodhicitta through recognizing that all beings have been your mother, etc., but hasn't talked about equanimity. And it's often the Mandarin text talks about the importance of this process of bodhicitta without talking about the importance of equanimity is a prelude to even being able to generate those minds.
Well, no, I mean, it is definitely mentioned, and we just didn't get around to it. But sure, we have to first cultivate equanimity before the first of the seven steps of cause and effect. If we still discriminate beings through attachment, aversion, and ignorance, then we can't generate heartwarming love. It's not counted as one of the steps. And in the equalizing and exchanging self and others, the equanimity is even much, much stronger. I guess Geshe-Jama Tetrock said that still in the seven steps of cause and effect, you do develop equanimity, but there's still a subtle feeling of closeness to some and distance from others. And you need the more powerful meditation and equanimity in equalizing and exchanging self and others to get rid of that subtle discrimination. We're going to meditate on it anyway. Well, not tonight. But.
It's not a sorry question, but is it possible to have a conflict between attachment and compassion?
A conflict between attachment and compassion, as an example?
For example, my mother was dying, and she was burning for fear, and you have compassion, you walk down, trying to get cool.
Not wanting. Oh, yeah. Of course, every virtuous attitude has to fight our customary, deluded way of seeing the world. Whenever one tries to cultivate virtue, there is obstacles. Do bring about conflict in the mind. Even external obstacles arise when we try to do something virtuous. This is why Lama Zopa cheered joyfully when he heard about the fire in the monastery. I didn't. And particularly when somebody extremely close to us, to whom we are attached, it's difficult to be not dispassionate, but to be aware that, you know, whatever is born will die, or whoever is born will die, and impermanence, and etc. Like Marpa's favourite son was murdered, and I think Marpa was weeping, and one of his foolish students said, "Well, if he's just an illusion, why are you crying?" And Marpa replied wrathfully, "He was a super illusion."
I think it's Holden said, and I'm making the statement completely, but I think he said, if you go to have attachment, it's better to be attached to his positives or virtue than so just, I think, implying the idea of how hard it is actually, because this is truly a poison. That within our continuum until we completely remove this, to maybe to understand a little bit more.
Yeah, it's the way they say, you know, anger, it's easy to recognize the faults of anger, but attachment is like a hole in the shoe. It's worn out slowly over many, 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 many steps. And slowly, 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 you can get rid of attachment.
Can we be too kind?
Can we?
Ever be too kind?
Well, yeah. If when I became a monk, I started a clinic at the monastery in Nepal, and there was one young monk who had a boil on his thigh, and it was like fresh, wasn't ready for lancing or anything. I gave him some painkillers. And Lama Yeshe, my teacher, came on and said, "What's that?" I said, oh, that's for the pain, Mama. I'm not sure I should tell this story. Lamia, she slapped the boy in the thigh and said, he doesn't need that. I'm not sure that answers the question, but kindness has to be done with wisdom, I think that's basically. There's another story. When I was in Nepal, the town of Pokhara, the valley of Pokhara, was renowned for its oranges. Like throughout the Himalayas, Pokhara oranges were the best. Then an American tourist came by and saw them. He said, you need Californian oranges. And so he kindly donated a whole bunch of Californian oranges, which had a disease which totally wiped out all the Pokhara oranges. So, lack of intelligence can impede kindness. So kindness has to be associated with wisdom. Not just wisdom understanding ultimate reality of emptiness, but conventional wisdom as well. And I think Lama Yeshe's example, I don't know, I'm just speculating that, you know, this boil would have come to an end naturally. Painkillers would, the aspirin or Cody, whatever I gave him, can't remember, wouldn't have done much. And it was just something, it was a karmic ripening, it would come to a point and then it would dissipate naturally. I'm not sure what Lama was teaching me, but I really, but it's so often in medicine we tend to give symptomatic treatment, which in many cases doesn't work, and in many cases it causes more harm than help. Yeah. So was that what you had in mind about being too kind? Yeah. I think, yeah.
In relation to the same thing, sort of thing, people who find kindness sickly. In other words, they don't want to.
Oh, I see. Subjectively.
Particularly if it's a lot of kindness, they don't actually really want it. They just want their own space, basically. They don't want the kindness. We might want to be kind.
Be kind, give them their space.
Yeah.
Well, we just have to check up. I mean, why do we have aversion to somebody who's overly kind to us, trying to help? Well, it could be an affront to our pride and our sense of self-sufficiency and leave me alone, I can fix this. Don't talk to me. We might discriminate the person as negatively, and we don't want their advice. I mean, children and parents.
It could be that, or it could be that they can.
Oh, of course. But you pointed out the subject who's receiving kindness, right? Why do we feel aversion? So the subject who feels aversion has to check up. Yeah, oh, it's interesting. We really do have to constantly be mindful of what we're thinking and why we're thinking it. Because we are habitually self-centered. This is a survival factor, to be self-sufficient and independent and in control of one's life. And this is why teenagers who have, pre-teens, have depended so much upon their parents, you know, for guidance and for money, you know, for whatever they needed, for protection and comfort, and then they try to break out of that, and so they go to the other extreme of rejecting parental involvement in their lives. And as adults, we maintain the continuity of that concept or that idea to be self-sufficient and independent. So we resent what we perceive as interference in our lives. So the problem's in our mind. I mean, Lama Sofa Rinpoche for 30 or 40 years had a persistent cough when he was teaching. And if he'd ever kept the medicines that people had given him, he would fill the room this big for his cough. He never took one. But he always accepted what people offered with gratefulness and appreciation, you know. It was appreciation for their kind thought.
I wouldn't appreciate if I gave somebody something and they didn't use it.
Yeah, but they didn't know that. They didn't have to know that.
I think it's quite skillful. Because how would you feel if you said, no, no, I don't want you to go to
medicine?
I think it's sincere. But you'll be vulnerable probably.
No, if people are sincere and honest, and the Buddha told us to be honest, sincere,
it's not being dishonest. He's thanking them for their consideration and their care.
Yeah, but it's a waste of their money.
He didn't ask them to buy it. Hey, I've got a heap of stuff up there too that I don't use.
I'll bring it down.
I think Zopa means patience, and his cough was meant to make us be patient. It was a teaching. That's right. It's not the waste. And he didn't ask them to. I have people. I mean, I tell people, no. I don't want it. It happened last week. I do not need it. They get it. They insist. Give it to me. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah, but at least you say, I don't want it.
No, this...
That's the honesty of it. I don't like
it. No, but when they give it, I don't say, I'm not going to use this.
But everyone knows I'm not going to use it. Because you've already said.
So this is like what Geshe said today, there is about making offerings to Buddha, you know, it's not just about what Buddha needs them.
No, it's the Sangha's responsibility to accept offerings. It's the Bodhisattva's responsibility to accept offerings, whether you need them or not. It's part of love. What'd you say? Then you don't have a problem.
I just wanted to ask you the benefit of the visualization meditation.
Yeah.
I've said to you, because I struggle with it a lot.
Because?
I struggle with it.
Yeah. Oh, sure. So do I. It does take time to train our mind to be able to generate a mental image and for focusing upon. But we can do it because, you know, if you close your eyes and I ask you to visualize a hamburger, it's pretty easy. Or to visualize, you know, the house where you live, it's there. It can be done. I'm just saying it can be done through familiarity. And secondly, the image of Buddha is an extremely powerful image. Of course, it's not the Buddha, but the proportions and the shape and the appearance are even. An insect that perceives a statue of Buddha receives a beneficial imprint upon their mind. And so if we familiarize ourselves with the image of Buddha, constantly there is a positive, a very, very positive imprint is being established upon our mind stream. Lama Tsongkhapa said that to gain Kamabhati, single point of concentration, an excellent object is the image of Shakyamuni Buddha.
So he develops that concentration.
Sorry?
He develops that concentration.
To use as your object of concentration to gain your mental quiescence. So for us, then, I think, you know, a situation like this, and also this is the method that the lamas have taught us since the early 70s, the Shakyamuni Buddha visualization, it is this infinite benefit in doing it. You can achieve karma biting on a mental image of a hamburger, possible. But that doesn't create much virtue in your mind. Not non-virtue, but...
I guess I kind of felt a bit adverse to it because it seems to be conceptualization, and my impression was the object of my meditation should be non-conceptualization.
But at the moment our minds are totally conceptualizing.
Yeah.
And so we use that activity to gain single point of concentration and vipassana, and then we go beyond that to the non-conceptual direct awareness. We have no choice. We have to utilize the conceptualizing activity of our mind as part of the path and then throw it away. Like a Buddha's mind has no conceptual activity whatsoever.
But you can't have a conceptual mind without first generating
a conceptual
aspect.
Yeah, that's right. It's a means to an end.
So just following on from Amanda's question about kindness and being too kind, often one might have the kindness in one's heart but not the wisdom, which leaves you at risk of either saying the wrong thing or doing nothing. If you do nothing, you become a doormat, and people that generates more bad karma for that person. I find that a real dilemma as to what to do when I don't have the wisdom to handle things.
Sure, I think we all do. But the good heart, the kind heart, is doing something. It's doing something extremely powerful, and that alone, even without words, even without physical actions, that alone is of great benefit, and others can pick it up. When there's genuine warmth and love, even in the face of insult or hurt or whatever is coming, you are doing something extremely powerful. And it might take time for the other person to recognize it. It may not even recognize it. But it's doing something. Getting angry is also doing something, but no good. So don't ever feel dismay that, you know, you want to help so much but you can't see what to do. We all face these situations, particularly within families and parents and their children. I can see the children making what the parents know through their own experience to be big mistakes, and they can't get a word out because they're rejected. But to maintain the love, to never reject the child, even though they may do terrible things, but to never abandon kindness and concern for those who, you know, for whom you're responsible, even for those whom you're not responsible, but particularly in those situations where we feel so frustrated that we don't know what to do. Being kind is great.
time and think of insects, worms, etc., I wonder what things might fall into that category and where do microorganisms such as bacteria fit in, do they fit in at all?
Wow, that's... in terms of rebirth states and your ability to experience happiness, humans are sort of in the middle. There are divine beings at various levels, higher in terms of their ability to experience mental peace and pleasure. Animals have less capacity because of their, mainly their nervous systems, their brains, don't allow their faculty of intelligence to be manifest. They have the faculty, but they don't. They got the software over the hardware. And then hungry ghosts and hell beings. So they're almost constant pain. Buddha did talk about minute sentient beings in the water that we can't see. And so symbolically, monks and nuns are given a strainer when they take vows, and they're supposed to strain the water from the rivers and the creeks before drinking it, even though they can't see what they're straining. Well, some of you can see wrigglers and things, but and Buddha said that there are a vast number of sentient beings in our body, on our skin. Certainly, biologically, we know there are tiny, tiny little mites and on the skin, and I think they would be sentient beings. They have eyes, legs, etc. Even the worms in our intestines. Maybe not so much in Australia, but in India for sure. I think they're sentient beings. As far as I'm concerned, the jury's out regarding bacteria and viruses. Although the jury's out, I'm convinced that they are not sentient beings. I believe, I don't know, I believe they are not sentient beings. And I take penicillin if I need it.
So are there other beings that fall in that category of sentient beings beneath us, apart from worms, insects, etc.?
I can't remember the context. Again, I said beneath us. He said beneath in terms of
frustrations, when you're frustrated and your body was going under the ground,
yeah,
and thinking of the things beneath us and bringing them out of the suffering there.
Oh, I see, yeah. Yeah, there's a visualization. When doing prostrations, initially, when you do a full length, you know, you prostrate to overcome pride, but then you quickly get up. You don't lie down there, have a break, and you think that as I get up quickly, may I quickly lift all sentient beings out of the lower realms. So for the lower realms, may they get out, and may I lead them. So it's sort of a meditation. Hey? England's down there, yeah, all the ponds. Sure. But as His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, sometimes we have to laugh at Vasubandhu. Ho ho ho. Vasubandhu's presentation of the cosmos in the Abhidhamma Kosha, the flat earth, etc.
Are the whole beings actually physically underground?
According to Vasubandhu, yes. But according to the Mahayana teachings, because the Abhidhamma Kosha is according to the Sotran Tika school, according to the Chittamatra and the Majjhimika schools, the hell realms are not anywhere in relationship to us. They, when somebody dies and their karma to be reborn in a hell has ripened at death, then after the intermediate state, we create our own hell.
There's so, not a spatial element to it. It's
not in relationship to the human world. And when the being, when the hell beings die, their hell, created by their karma, ceases.
There seems to be different accounts of it. Because I read that Theravadan group recently, and they were adamant that it was actually a spatial, physical.
Yeah, that's what I say. Abhidhamma Kosha says that.
Yeah.
And it's according to the Sotan Tika critique of the Vibhasika school. But the Majjhimika, the Mahayana schools, don't accept that.
So there is a special element, but it's only through the eyes of the deceiver, the being that's experiencing that.
Oh yeah, for them they experience burning and freezing in hot and cold hells, and the demons are hallucination demons. They're not out there waiting for you with pitchforks. They're hallucinations.
They're not actually persons.
They're not sentient beings.
Rinpoche once said that the Toshiba Dharamsala, which is Toshiba's on the hill, is the invitation to step down, look up hell, which is not a problem. He said, so tonight, maybe tonight we're going to say goodbye and wake up and the whole hill's on fire. And God is there, just there.
Oh, often we talk about people living in their own world, just because they're humans. Helen?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about my sister
who
has a terrible paranoia, and she has such a different perception of what's going on around her. So the car parked on the street, I see as a person who is just listening to the music or chilling out at lunchtime, to her that is a good enemy spying on her and sending messages to a neighbour about her. So I have no problem with her in that sense, because I know that she has kind of lived that so long. The Buddha said check up on everything, yeah? Check up, try to get as much insight into things as you can.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so then the Mahayana teaching said you can't do that a bodhicitta unless you believe it or think it being between your mother.
Yeah.
And to me that's a powerful force kind of explanation, because I can never do that 7-point meditation because I have no insight into the incarnation.
You have no, yeah.
Right. So that means I'm doomed in developing bodhicitta.
Well, you're not doomed because everything can change, and you, by investigating, contemplating the meaning of rebirth, you can come around. If it's true, then the more you investigate, the clearer it will become. If it's not true, the more you investigate, the more it will dissipate. It will not be true. So it's up to you. I didn't believe in reincarnation either when I first heard the teachings at all. But somehow, investigate, think, what is the nature of the mind? Where does the mind come from? And, then come around. So you're not doomed. You have opportunity to check up. In regard to the previous point, a psychiatrist friend of mine said that the definition of paranoia, not a definition but an example of paranoia, is that you're at a football game at the MCG, and when the players go into a huddle between quarters, you think they're talking about you. Okay.